Good day, and welcome to another Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing, bladesmithing, and everything in between, with a heavy focus on talent in the Great White North. I'm talking about Canada, eh? But today, I'm heading across the pond. Gonna go speak with Michael Budd in Ireland. This man's been blacksmithing for a while, and he knows a thing or two about it. So sit back, relax, and get ready to soak up some great information.
Where are you located right now?
Well, I'm in Sligo, County Sligo, which is it's in the northwest of Ireland. So if you kind of draw a line across from Dublin to Galway and then go up, you will hit County Sligo.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's literally next stop would be the Maritimes in Canada. Like, if you went west of where we are now.
Gotcha. Right. There's nothing in between, Just wide open waters.
No, yes. We're just on the Atlantic coast. Oh, yeah.
Maybe you might find Iceland in there somewhere if you're lucky.
No, Iceland's north of us.
Oh, okay. Well, like I said, if you're lucky, maybe you varied off the straight path.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. You'd have to vary, yeah.
You've been in that area your entire life, or is that where you born?
No. I was born in Portsmouth in the south coast of England.
So okay.
We moved here 23 years ago. We moved here. When our daughter was born.
Yeah. I was going to say life is taking a big turn for you at that point. Then you. Bringing children into the world, moving.
Yeah, it was massive. And that's when I came to Ireland and got into forge work as well. So there was massive changes all in that small time frame.
Everything you weren't blacksmithing before you moved to Ireland?
No, I trained, my dad and my brother were both welders. And then I trained in metal fabrication when I left school. And then I just didn't want to do it. So I stopped and did loads of various jobs. And then when I moved to Ireland, I my wife found a blacksmith because she said, oh, what have you always wanted to do? And I said, this will shut her up, you know? And I said, oh, I always want to be a blacksmith. And then she went and found somebody who needed me. So I went up and helped him out. I went up for an interview and didn't come back all day. And that was it. Then I was sold. As soon as I walked into the place, I was sold. There was no going back. And
awesome.
And there hasn't been since. You know? And it was fantastic.
You know? So who is that you hadn't worked with?
He's a guy called Brian Halpin.
Okay.
And he's originally from Arizona. He ended up in Ireland for some random reason.
What the heck is that?
I know. He ended up. He ended up, if I remember this right, it was a long time ago now, but he ended up in Ireland via Germany and the UK because he was in the US Marines stationed in Germany. And then back then, the reason he joined the Marines was to get a college education.
Yeah.
And then he could pretty much choose where to go. And he decided to study archaeology, I think, or history in London after he left the Marines, ended up in London, got fed up with London, and ended up getting a job here in Sligo. Came here, then got into forge work. So he was an interesting guy. I'm sure he's still interesting. I just haven't seen him for a few years. But he was an interesting guy. He'd had quite a life.
So that leads into the next question I was going to ask you about him. Is he still blacksmithing?
Yeah. As far as I know. As far as I know, I haven't seen him. He actually doesn't live far from where I live. We just don't very often bump into each other, you know,
Which
is strange. Yeah. But we don't. We very rarely bump into each other. I haven't seen him, God, for about 10 years, I think, was the last time I actually bumped into him. I don't think he's on social media or anything like that. Kind of is a little bit reclusive, not really reclusive. He's quite a sociable person, but he wouldn't be putting himself out there on social media, as far as I know, and he doesn't have a website, and, you know, like, he's a bit more old school.
I definitely have to wonder about that ideology when it comes to what we do and making money, because the social medias have definitely proven themselves worthwhile when it comes to marketing aspects and being able to produce a finer business, if you may. There's guys that do it, right?
Yeah, but you're coming at it from the same point of view I'm coming at it, which is about the idea of business. For me, social media is business, and it's a way to promote yourself.
Definitely.
That's not everybody's first priority. Mm-hmm. And some people just have a different outlook on it. But I'm probably at the older end of that generation. You know, social media came along a little bit after I started my business, and it was a handy way to promote the business, you know, where you were in control of it. But a lot of people, even my age, a lot of my friends from like growing up and in my 20s aren't on social media. They can't be bothered with it, you know. The younger generation, that would seem weird, wouldn't it? Because everyone's on social media.
Yeah, no, I get that for sure.
Yeah, but the older generation, and then some of the older blacksmiths are on there, and they're quite good on there. They're posting stuff and they're chatting to people and they're doing all the things. But some just aren't. Some just can't be asked for. I don't blame them. You know, I don't know whether I'd really bother with it too much if I was earning money in a way that it was coming regardless. So I know older blacksmiths, and they've had 30, 40 years their forge has been running, and they've got the clientele that work will come in regardless. They don't need it. No. Like the blacksmith in my hometown, Pete Clutterbuck, he started his forge up in 1970, in the year I was born. And he just doesn't need social media because his work is coming to him. Everyone knows him in the city. So the work is going to come there. It's different for us, isn't it?
Yeah. You answered another question that I was going to ask you there too, is if you don't mind me asking, is approximately how old you are, and born in 1970, that throws you into the...
Yeah,
55, 54, sorry. Yeah.
53. Yeah, dear, don't make me older than I am. Jesus, 53 is bad enough. Yeah,
frickin'. Hey, but I'm turning 42 right away, and I'm feeling it myself, man. I'm feeling it too. 42, and I miss those younger days. I'll tell you what, it only goes downhill from here.
Yeah. No, that's not true. It gets better. It gets better as you get older. Once the kids have left school, then it starts to get a lot better. You're preoccupied to start. Do you have children, Nando?
I do. I have a 7-year-old child, and I totally get what you're saying, man. Life is so preoccupied with the child right now. I love it. Absolutely love her to death, and I love everything that we do together. But
of course, But it's hard work.
Yeah, totally. My world's a different world than it was 7 years ago, man. Completely different world.
Yeah.
I wouldn't change it for the life of me, but...
No, but you don't realize when you come out the other side of it. So it's hard for you to imagine now because you've got a 7-year-old. But it's something that creeps up on you slowly. But slowly, your kids don't need you as much, and then that frees you up, and then you can start doing stuff again that you just didn't have time for. So I feel now I'm in the prime of my life because being able to do stuff that I didn't have time for. 10 years ago, I didn't have time for working out or even going for a walk. I just didn't have
time. How old are your kids?
Running the forge. Molly is 23 and George has just turned 21.
Nice, yeah. What are they doing with themselves?
Well, Molly works as she's a trainee costume designer in the film industry.
Awesome.
And George was my apprentice, so he trained with me and went to Hereford, and he's just finished his journey. So he went over to England. He went to Pete Clutterbuck, who's the blacksmith in my hometown, who knew my dad. And then he went to, I will butcher his surname if I try it, but he's a blacksmith called Tom. God, I can't remember his surname, but I know I butcher it. It's like a German surname. And he was down in Eastbourne in the south of England. And then he went up to Top & Co. up in Yorkshire, who do a lot of restoration, like they do like all the royal palaces and things like that.
Ooh,
so he
buddy.
Was working on, what was he? I think he was working on the gates to the Houses of Parliament while he was there.
Then,
yeah, it was quite interesting. But now he's at that crossroads, I think. He's not sure. You know that thing where he badgered me from about the age of 5 years old. Can I come into the forge? Can I come into the forge? And I said, oh, no, not until you're 11. Literally, I came downstairs on his 11th birthday and he was waiting at the front door for me.
No way.
And so I was like, oh, Jesus, okay. So anyway, he came into the forge on Saturdays from then on. And then he wanted to do his apprenticeship. So, yeah, okay. And then I think now he's like, do I really want to do this for the rest of my life? So he's kind of at home at the moment. He knows he doesn't want to work with his dad anymore.
Shit.
And so I think I've heard this story quite a lot, actually. One of my favorite blacksmiths, I don't know whether you heard of him, it's a guy called Dave Tucker in the UK. And if you've never seen his work, check it out. Because like his work is, you know, that thing where somebody who does something and it looks so simple and clean, but like we know how hard that is to achieve, to mm-hmm. make something simple and clean looking. Well, Dave Tucker is like, but I know I met him years ago now, back in 2007. It was at a forge in over in England. And he was saying that he actually went off and followed another career for a while. Because his dad, I think his dad was a blacksmith as well, and he trained with his dad and just decided, oh, do you know what, I've had enough. And then he came back into it in his 30s. I'm just in love with his work. I always have been. Like, his work is just beautiful, beautiful.
Right. I feel like once you begin to master metal, to try to lose that from you would be next to impossible. Like, I can't imagine myself ever being able to walk away from the idea of working with metal. Maybe yeah, not blacksmithing.
When did you start? When did you start working with metal?
That's an interesting question, to be honest, because I grew up in a mining town, born and raised in Flin Flon, Manitoba, which is a gold mine, copper mine, zinc mine, diamond mines, all you name it, is everything is up there. And
yeah.
So I grew up around, you know, big machinery. There was a massive smelter in town that was always burning. So I was literally breathing metal dust since I was a baby, right? But
yeah.
The first time I laid my hands on steel and actually worked with it, I can't pinpoint for sure what that first time was. I know, like, right from a young age, playing with wood and knives was always like, you know, finding my grandpa's knife and carving wood with it and stuff like that, and going out in the bush and making forts. That was always huge. And I don't know how that sounds coming from somebody being in Ireland. The idea of going out in the bush and making forts. I don't know what it's like.
Our kids did the same thing here. And then we did it in our own way. I grew up in a city, but we did it in our own way. Only we didn't have, we had the cemetery at the bottom of the road. Like, it sounds weird.
Yeah.
But in there, cause it was, and climb trees and make dens. And
that's kind of what I mean. Like, when I picture somebody like in Ireland or Germany or the UK trying to go into the bush to make a fort, it's like, well, you're kind of, it's so packed full of people there that it's hard to get away from
it
people
is.
Too, right?
It is. Well, it's a bit easier here. Like, this is the least densely populated area in the whole of Europe, the northwest of Ireland. So you can go off and lose yourself and you won't see anyone. You go out for a walk and you won't see anybody. You know, like above my forge is, there's megalithic tombs above my forge. And if I go up there at lunchtime for a walk, you might see the odd German tourist. But other than that, you can go up. You can go up. You can go into the tombs. There's nobody out there. There's no tourist board, like office or anything like that. You can just walk up there. And you'd be on your own and you can go up and clear your head. But there are lots of places like that in Europe. It's nowhere near on the level that you're talking about.
Right.
You can get off and find yourself.
If you look at the map of Canada and pinpoint where Flin Flon, Manitoba is and kind of zoom in to see what's around there, you'll quickly realize that you could throw the entirety of Ireland in the same spot and barely touch anything else civilized. So it's pretty crazy.
It blew my mind the first time I came over and I flew from Toronto up to Sydney and Cape Breton.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, this is unbelievable. No, I think it was Halifax and then I had a connection flight up to Sydney. But I couldn't believe it. Just flying. There was nothing. It was just mountains. It was just mountains and forest. Yeah. A couple of hours or whatever. And I was like, Jesus, this is incredible. And lakes. And I was just blown away by it. I was looking around the plane and everyone else has obviously done this trip a few times. And everyone was looking at the little screens on the back of the seat in front. And I'm like, I can't believe people aren't looking out the window at this. It blew my mind, coming from Britain and Ireland. It was kind of like, oh my God, this is incredible.
I don't know. I've grown up here and I still get blown away by it. Every time I'm in a plane, I like to look out the window and soak up the landscape here. We live in a very, very beautiful country. We're blessed to be here for sure.
Yeah. Well, if you want to blow your mind, you need to go to Russia. Get on a flight from Russia across. So get on a flight in Moscow and go across to Siberia. And it's just 5 hours of forest. It's just five hours of forest. It's like driving across the Atlantic. It's like flying across the Atlantic only on with forest instead of sea. It's unbelievable. And then you're only halfway across the country.
Northern Canada is very much the same way, man.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. And from my perspective, when you go to places like that, you're just kind of going, what the fuck is going on here? and then the people you meet, the weird thing is that you meet similar types of people wherever you go in the world. You'll meet those people that literally could walk out of their back door and survive on nothing, you know. Even when you're living in a city, you'll meet those people, you know.
That's exactly the type of person I strive to be able to do that. I've been working to pick up my hunting skills a lot more in the last couple of years here, because that's what I would like to be, that person, man. And I honestly believe that as a Canadian, that should be how all Canadians live, but things are changing.
It's kind of each to their own, isn't it? It's sad. Yeah. I think there still are people out there that are attracted to that life and want to be that person and want to be self-sufficient. That's one of the reasons we moved to the northwest of Ireland, that originally we wanted to be self-sufficient. And then obviously because my wife's a goldsmith, so our careers become laser focused. So initially we had pigs and we had goats and we did, but then we realized we don't have time to be keeping pigs and goats anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, we still got chickens. But we just,
awesome.
Your careers take up so much of your time and you have to be, because you have to be, you know yourself, you're in charge of your own development as a craftsperson. You've got to develop those skills. There's no one to teach you this technique and you have to learn that. So you're in charge of that. Then you're in charge of designing all the work and delivering it and ordering all the stock and marketing it. Like that leaves very little room then to even to have a hobby.
No? Well, and there's a side to that too, that you have, you get to a point where you realize that how much time and effort it takes for you to go and milk the cows and maintain the stable for them and the equipment for them and everything else that goes into that. You could just hop into the blacksmith shop, make five times as much money producing what you're good at doing.
Yeah.
Pump that stuff out and just go buy your own milk, right? Or trade it with the farmer down the road for
his milk. We're lucky. Right? We know loads of people around here that do organic, different types of organic farming. And so, in fact, my wife has just, because she teaches courses as well, like in jewelry making. And so one of the organic farmers has just got a course off her. And in return, he's given us a load of beef. Organic beef.
That's awesome, dude. Right there. That's the shit I'm talking about, man. And you know
that's,
what?
That's important.
It's right here in the Strange Brew catalog or encyclopedia. All hosers should know what a moose knuckle is, eh?
What's a moose knuckle? Hold on.
That's a good question. Moose knuckle. Urban Dictionary it.
All right. Okay.
I will. It's one of those things. Yeah. So myself working with metal, the history there is a little, for me to pinpoint it is, I'm not sure. I know that there was a connection for it getting into the mines and stuff like that eventually. Where did it start for you though, dude? Where did you start working with metal? Like your dad was a welder.
Yeah, as a kid, I'd go in with my dad and help him. What he called his moody jobs. So he was kind of, my dad was a little bit of a genius, but he worked for an engineering company on the docks. And it was like, if something came in and no one could figure out how to do it, it was just like, I'll give it to Fred. He'll sort it out. And so he was just left. He just had the keys to the workshop. And if he wanted to come in on Saturday and do something, his boss just let him at it. Nice. So he would go in and make weird contraptions for the trawlermen and fix gear for them. And also he used to, when he first left school, my granddad bought him a horse and cart and he used to deliver coal. And so you'd get people come in and get him, he'd repair their carts or stuff like things like that on a Saturday. He would do all, so I'd go in and help him with that. So like, he was the first person. He taught me how to just tack weld with the arc welder. I remember that. That's the first thing I remember is him teaching me. He had an old Oxford oil cooled welder, and he'd have me tacking things up, you know. And I must have been about, I guess I would have been about 10 or 11 then, just doing things like that. And he'd be fixing it. My dad, I don't think my dad ever bought a car that he didn't strip down and rebuild. So he'd buy a car, like, I remember once we bought a brand new washing machine and I came home 6 months later. I came home from work and my dad had stripped it in the kitchen. I said, what are you doing, Dad? And he said, well, there's a noise in there. It's under guarantee. I said, they will come out and fix that for you. Ah, no, I'll do it myself. Like, mm-hmm. He was that type of person, you know? So anyway, he kind of put the welder in my hand and, started from that. And I can remember going to like my dad would do, he'd get Pete, the local blacksmith, he would kind of get him some metal out the back door sort of thing. So on Saturday, sometimes we'd load up the flatbed truck and we'd drive down to Pete's forge. And so I remember Pete's forge from about 10 years old.
Pete had a good hookup. Kind of
perked my interest. Well, I was too embarrassed. I wish I had some, because I knew I was interested in that, and I wish that I wasn't as shy. I wish I'd gone down. I was telling Pete this actually. I was over in England earlier this year and went out for a pint with Pete and his stepson, and they both run the forge together now. And I was saying to him, I wish I'd come into you and said I want to be a blacksmith, but I was too embarrassed. This would have been 1986 when I left school, and I was just too embarrassed to do that. And I wish I'd had the courage
right
to do that. You know,
right.
I didn't miss my opportunity the second time around. I was in England. My wife phoned me up and she said, you need to get back here now. I've just heard of a blacksmith who actually needs somebody to help him. And I got up on a plane the next day and I got home. And the day after that, I drove straight up to Brian's.
No way.
And that was it then. And I started, I didn't come home that day. I really started that day.
I didn't come home
for about 4 or 5 hours. And then the next day I was there on site. We were working on site doing railings and I was on site the next day with him he had this Land Rover, but it had like these wheels on it that had oversized lug nuts on. And so I arrived at his forge and he was swearing and throwing stuff around the forge and he'd lost the spanner for this lug nuts. And they were like a particular like imperial size. Cause it was a, I don't know whether you know Land Rovers, but it was a 2A, it was a series 2A Land Rover. And so, and he'd done loads of modifications. He put a Perkins engine in it and like all sorts of stuff he'd done to it. And anyway, he couldn't find the wheel brace and he was swearing. And so in the end, he just said, oh, fuck it, we'll make one. And I just watched him make one.
Nice.
And I was just like, I'm never doing anything else other than this. Because the idea then of not only making your work, but making the tools to make your work, that just blew me away.
Yeah.
And I'd never really thought of a blacksmith doing that until that moment. I'd never really thought. And I loved that. I loved the fact that we had a job. And it's still the same way. A job comes in and you need to make a certain amount of tooling to do that particular job. And I just love that process. Yeah,
definitely.
It's a beautiful thing. Yeah. And people come into the forge. I don't know if you get that. People come into my forge and say, oh, where'd you get all these tools from? So I made them. And it blows their minds. They're like, what?
Yeah, buddy.
What about these ones up here? Yeah, made those. What about those? Yeah, we made those too.
Man, okay, so you're taking me into a, like, you took me down a bit of a mental road there, because I lost myself as you're saying that. I started daydreaming, thinking about how that's exactly what it is, dude, is this ability to be able to make anything you can dream of almost outside of know, electronic contraptions. And even that, is it beyond us? Everything we do, everything that comes out of a blacksmith's hands is eventually what this world has become. It all started on the face of an anvil at one point, right? Even electronics.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, like literally, virtually everything.
Well, it's Sam Townes' favorite quote is, the modern world was forged on the face of an anvil.
Yeah, and then we have a saying over here and in England, which is by the hammer and the hand, all arts do stand.
Oh, beautiful, like, dude.
I think that's the motto of the Worshipful Company of Blacksmiths in London.
Okay.
I think that's their motto. I'm pretty certain it is. But that was the whole idea. That's why they used to call it the King of Crafts. They used to call blacksmithing the king of crafts, because literally every other craft kind of relied. The ironic thing is, a lot of crafts, like I know a lot of stonemasons and things like that, and they had to learn how to forge their own chisels and stuff like that. They had to go off and they'd spent so many weeks in the forge. It was part of their apprenticeship. I don't know whether it still is, but, you know, like back in the day, there's a guy called Michael, who's from Yorkshire. He lives over here, and I think Michael must be coming up for 80 now, but he was saying that when he did his apprenticeship over in Yorkshire in England, he had to go into the forge and learn how to temper chisels, harden and temper chisels, and like forge them out.
It's a lesson in craftsmanship that I think engineers should be pushed towards a little bit more nowadays.
Yeah. It used to make me laugh. You always knew there was a new engineer in Portsmouth Dockyard, because my dad would come home with steam coming out of his ears, because they would come in and they'd be straight out of college, and obviously my dad was very experienced, and then my dad learned how to deal with them, which was to just nod and say, oh yeah, and you'll do it this way, and you'll use this steel, and you'll do that. yeah, yeah, okay. And then he would just do it how he knew it would work. And then they, then they would come in and they'd get really annoyed. And then they'd go, oh, I see what you've done there. Oh, that's a very good idea. And then after about 5 years, my dad would have trained them up. And then they'd get promoted. And then some other new college graduate would come in and my dad would be back to square one. You know, but they used to do all the repairs on the dockyard cranes and stuff like that. And they used to do all the, you know, safety testing of all the lifts, and it was a weird little company, McKinley's it was called. It was a strange little company. It doesn't exist now, sadly. But the equipment they had, like, I think they had like three
massive dockyards for sure.
Air hammers, and they had this massive floor standing fly press, you know, double footed.
Yeah.
And it must have been about 5.5 foot tall.
Oh,
and
man.
I remember as a kid playing with it and not thinking that the handle was going to come back round. And it came round and it hit me on the side of the head.
No.
And knocked me across the workshop. And my dad was in another room and he heard it. What's going on out there? And oh, nothing, Dad. I was like, oh, my God.
No kidding. This
big lump on the side of my head. And
oh, my God. Like,
and my dad was, this type of guy. He said, oh, what did you do with your head? Oh, I hit it. Oh, you won't do that again?
No.
That was it. It was like, you won't do that again. I was like, oh, maybe not. But, it's strange, that whole thing.
You got me a little excited here talking about the fly press and the big power hammers. And I think, oh, there she is. Oh, tell me about your tools. I mean, tools. I want to know, what are you rocking in your shop, dude? You got a power hammer? You got a press?
I do. I have a fairly small, it's an Anyang. It's only one of the 25 kg rams on it.
Okay.
It was as big as I could get into my old forge. We couldn't get anything bigger through the door because the door was only about 6 foot. It's like a standard size house door height wise.
Right.
And so I calculated that was as big as I could get in. I really wanted the 40 kg, but it wouldn't have fitted into the actual forge. So I've got that Anyang, and I bought that about 15 years ago, and it's never missed a beat.
Awesome, dude.
I remember people at the time saying, oh, don't buy one of those Chinese hammers. And I was like, oh, well, they're half the price of everything else. And it's been perfect. It's never missed anything.
And nowadays, Anyang is one of the main names in the business, man. Everybody's like, yeah, Anyang's the way to go.
Yeah.
There's, Casey Valinsky out of Canada here. He's distributed them across Canada. They've got presses as well that you can pick up.
So Anyang's
a household name.
I've got the older design. Since they redesigned it and gave it a clear space and a deeper throat, that was the limitations of mine. The throat's not deep enough on the power hammer, and there's not enough clear space, so it limits what tools you can use. So you're basically using it mostly for just drawing out metal, and you know, there's not a lot of room with the 25 kg for top tools. But then that's what you use the fly. That's what I use the fly press for.
What do you got for a fly press, buddy?
Texturing. It's only quite small. It's a Norton number 4.
Oh wow, that's it. It's a number 4, buddy.
Yeah, it's a nice little thing. But I'm actually I want to get a bigger one. I've seen a Norton number 6 that I got my eye on. It's a deep throat as well. So.
Oh yeah.
And it's in perfect condition.
You keep saying that word, you're getting me excited, bud.
everyone loves a deep throat.
In the blacksmithing community, hell yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, come on, in every community. no one ever turns it down.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And okay, so at number 4, dude, how you can swing that thing like easy then, right? Like it just flies around, I bet, when you go to give it a spin.
Yeah. And when I got it, it didn't have the balls. They're always the weights are always missing. And so I ended up buying the weights from a company in the UK, which I can't remember the name of the company. They're in the Midlands in the UK somewhere, and they basically make the castings.
Why are they always missing?
Steel boards.
Like, why?
Because people use them as decoration. That's why.
Yes.
You know, and so, yeah, so they go missing because somebody's put them on their gatepost or something.
Freaking hosers.
And that, they cost me more than the actual fly press cost me to get them.
Fuck.
I think the fly press cost me about 200 euros, and I think the balls.
Oh, dude.
The balls delivered to me from England cost about 280 euros or something.
Man, that is a damn good price for a fly press, dude. We don't find fly presses in Canada. That's half the issue. You just don't see them in Canada at all. When one goes for sale, it's like, I think the last one I saw go for sale, the guy was asking $3,000 for it, and it wasn't in the greatest of condition either. Yeah, dude.
Well, I'm gonna break your heart now.
Okay,
what was it? 2017. I went over to Peter Brunner's hammering. Over in he's forges just outside, so you know, 20 minutes or so outside of I've got to remember the name it's a place in Germany. It's just gone completely out of my head now, but anyway, he has this beautiful double footed fly press there, and I went in there, fell in love with it straight away. And it's quite big. It's quite a big fly press. I don't know how many thousands of pounds. It's probably about capacity. It's about twice the size of a Norton number 4, I would say. And I said, Jesus, where'd you get that from, Peter? And he said, oh, a local engineering company were throwing it out. And they said, if you can get it out of the skip, you can have it. So him and about six of his friends went down there, pulled it out of the skip and got it on the back of his truck. Got it back. And it was in perfect condition. They were just getting rid of it.
I can't be mad at that because I've come across similar scenarios before. I've been super lucky and I've gotten some amazing things for free, dude. So that's actually really awesome, dude, that he was able to salvage that way and be able to keep its life. How much of that shit has gone to the scrapyard over the years and has actually been destroyed, dude? Like, fuck.
I know. That's the scary thing is the amount of things that get sold for scrappage. And especially nowadays, because new, like, edicts and stupid things about you can't sell second-hand equipment if it's, you know, like, there's silly rules that, like, I can remember a technical college not far from me was getting rid of a load of stuff from their metalwork. They had a metalwork class, and they were getting rid of loads of stuff. And it literally done no work because it was in a metalwork school and the stuff. And I said, oh, I'd really love a geared drill press, and you've got one there. Could I buy it? Oh, no, you can't buy that. Oh, why not? Oh, no, it's all got to go off of scrap. We can't, because of insurance reasons, we can't sell it to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so it all went off to scrap.
Yep.
Lathes, all sorts of stuff. Yep. Well, you won't believe the equipment that left there. And then they just replaced it with all new stuff.
Yep.
Right.
Freaking mind-boggling, dude.
I find it scary. The first time I went over teaching in Germany, it was down in southern Germany, down in Baden-Württemberg, and I went. I got invited. Nobody knew who I was. I got invited over by my friend Bill, who was involved in this. You know, a water-powered hammer forge or hammer schmiede.
And so
they had like a small festival every year, and it was at night, and they'd bring all the forges outside, and everyone would be forging at night, and you'd have the glow of the forge, and it was very romantic. But anyway, I got invited by the local technical college to go and have a tour around their technical college. So I said, oh yeah, grand. And I went and had a walk around there, and they had all these blacksmith tools in a cupboard, and they said, oh, what do you think of these tools, and what do you think of this? Oh yeah, they're grand, and will this be okay for you? And I said, well, what are you talking about? I said, oh, we're getting rid of these, and they'll only go to the scrapyard here, so we'll just send them over to you in Ireland. And they sent me loads of I handed them out to other blacksmiths because they was like repeats. There was like, you know, six pairs of 40 mil bit wolf bit tongs and things like that. So I just like handed them out to people.
They just
filled a tea chest and sent it over to me.
It was lovely.
Yeah. And sadly, my friend Bill, he died last month.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear, man.
Just unexpectedly, and he was one of the nicest guys. He just turned up. I got a phone call one night from where my forge used to be in. And one of the guys I knew there said, "Oh, Jesus, there's this big German in town looking for you, Mike." And I said, put him in a B&B and I'll see him tomorrow morning. And they said, "Oh no, all the B&Bs are booked. There's two weddings in town." So I said, "All right, I'll come down." So anyway, I drove down there and went into the pub. And there was this, and Bill was about 6'4" and he was huge, like huge fella.
Yeah.
And long hair and everything. And anyway, we just instantly became like brothers. And he stayed with us for about a month on and off. He would go off walking. He would just go walking. You wouldn't see him for 4 days. And he'd come back, have a couple of days with us, come into the forge, and then he'd go off again. And we were in the forge one day, and he was very, very German about it. And he was like, "Oh, Michael, you have no oh God, what's it called now? Jesus. It's a type of anvil. It's a fucking stake anvil." He said, "You have no stake anvil, Michael." And I said, no, I've always wanted a stake anvil. "I have three of them." And I was like, "Oh, well, that's good for you," sort of thing. And I was like, "Oh, that's nice." I thought, this guy's taking the piss out of me. I swear he is. Anyway, he went back to Germany. 2 weeks later, a wooden box turned up and I couldn't get coke at the time. And he'd sent this postfeist over as a thank you for putting him up, and he'd patched the box with coke so that rather than using polystyrene or something like that, so I had this beautiful like 150-year-old anvil, stake anvil, and that kind of cemented our relationship. And I'd go over and visit him, he'd come over and visit me and stay here. And he was just a lovely guy, just lovely, you know. We had some great. We were planning a new adventure. I was encouraging him to get a new motorbike, and I was going to come over there on the bike, and we were going to drive off and see some of my journeymen, have a couple of weeks, and then that was our plan for next year. And then he just had, you know, just unexpectedly just died. He was only in his 60s.
You know? Oh shit, man.
But a lovely man, a lovely, lovely guy. You know, when you meet people and you just think, I'm better for knowing that person.
Yeah, yeah, totally, and, dude.
Yeah, he was one of those people.
Life is, you never know when it's gonna come to an end for you, man. And you gotta soak up every last minute you can. Sounds like you met a pretty decent guy there, dude.
Ah, he was. And he was always full of funny little sayings and, like, you know, and he'd tell you little tiny stories, and you'd be exhausted. If you went over to stay with him, by the end of the week or the 2 weeks, you would be exhausted because he'd want to take you everywhere and show you everything. And he was so knowledgeable. "Oh, we'll have to go and see Carl here because Carl forges scythes, and if we go past his forge, he'll be upset with us, and you'd have to go and see Carl," and then that would be half a day, and then you'd be off somewhere else, and he'd say, "Oh, we have to go up here because it's a castle you'll be interested in," and you'd get home at like 10 o'clock at night back to his flat, and he had this amazing flat. It was in his apartment was in the walls of the old town war, the old town wars.
It was part of it. It was still left there.
And that was his apartment. And his forge was something like 250 years old, and it had perfectly flat polished concrete floor that they'd forged 200 years ago, and it was perfectly flat. And there was the guy who owned his forge, his wine cellar was underneath.
Crazy. So
Bill couldn't have a power hammer. That was the only thing he couldn't do. He couldn't have a power hammer.
Yeah.
Forge.
Shit.
But it was crazy going over to see him. He was such a lovely, lovely guy. So he'll be sorely missed by me and my family as well. My wife and kids really loved Bill. So,
yeah.
And he was the most un-German guy you ever met. You know, Ireland was his spiritual home.
Hmm.
You know? And he would have moved to Ireland in a heartbeat if he could.
How far is Germany from Ireland? I'm terrible with my
2.5 hour flight, two hour plane ride.
If you wanted to drive there, could you?
You can take a ferry across to France from I think there's one in Cork and there might be one in Waterford or Wexford.
Okay.
So you can get a ferry across to France, and then you can just drive. Just drive. So you're talking probably about an 8 hours drive.
Oh, yeah.
Something like that. Depending where you're going. Like when I was a kid, when I was in my 20s, my friends were in a band and I was their roadie and we'd go over. I was the only roadie in the world that didn't have a driving license. It was like, at the time I couldn't drive and it was like, you can be our roadie. I can't drive. I don't worry. Just help us with the boxes. Free holiday for you, mate. And we would just go over there in the summer and we'd drive around Germany and France and places like that and Holland. I'm going from gig to gig. And we had some great times. Great times. And met amazing people. Amazing people. Like, I'm always surprised by that when you go around the world and everywhere I've ever gone, people are friendly. And you meet, if you're open to it, you'll meet interesting people.
Yep.
You know?
100%. It's come up before so many times in my process of trying to find new people to bring on the podcast and chatting with somebody that might not be in the industry, may have not been in the industry for very long. I've chatted with people who are like, dude, I've been doing this for like a year and you want to bring me on the podcast? Yes, I do. You genuinely have an interesting story to you. I guarantee you there's things I'm going to learn by chatting with you. I would love to bring you on the podcast. There's not too many people where I would turn a conversation with them down because, like you said, everybody has something valuable to talk about. Everybody.
Yeah, and also it's that thing. I'm always a big one of telling people that you can always learn. No matter how long you've been doing whatever it is, you can always learn. And you can always learn from people that are coming in with fresh eyes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they come in, why do you do it that way? Oh, because of this. But wouldn't it be easier if you just did this? And you're like, well, hold on a minute. They've got a point there. But you've been trained or you've trained yourself to this is the only way it can be done.
Yeah.
You know? And sometimes as industries, we can fall into that trap. We do not do this. And then somebody turns around one day and says, well, why don't we? And it's just somebody once upon a time said, you don't do that. But nobody actually tried doing it, you know?
Yep.
And then somebody tries it and that's how you get progression, you know? But sometimes it takes the fresh eye to do that. Somebody who doesn't know any better. You see it in music, you see it in film, you see it all types of art, you see it in sport, you know, the people that come in and just try something new because they're not scared to make a fool of themselves or they don't know any better and they try something, you know, and somebody go and it's like, oh Jesus, we don't normally do that, and they said but it worked, didn't it?
And this is kind of taking us away from talking about the tools in your shop, but you're bringing music. And one of the things that you've brought up that comes up with the music aspect, man, King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard falls so hard into what you're talking about. I was talking to somebody else about this at work who's a musician. I'm not necessarily a musician myself at all, but this other person huge into playing guitar, and they're explaining to me one of the unique things about King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard is the fact that they tune their instruments completely different in the aspect of a way that other musicians would look at it and be like, but that's not the proper way to do it.
Yeah.
That's great that it's not the proper way to do it. Look what the look what these guys have produced. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, look, the history of innovation, but the history of music is people that broke rules and broke molds. Yeah. And it's the same with all art form. It's the people that broke, the people we remember are the people that broke the rules.
That's
the right way. Like, it's the best advice I can give to anybody that wants to do forge work or any type of artistic endeavor is to kind of go back and have a look at the history of your art form or the history of art in general. And you will find, especially when you're, you know, you have those moments where things aren't going right for you, for your career.
Mm-hmm.
Going back and knowing a little bit about art history, you realize this is a common theme. You know, literally all of the artists that we know of today had major setbacks. Some of them never got past that and produced some of the best work you will ever see. Some people did that. I watched a great documentary about Rembrandt just a few weeks ago. And like, he was literally on top of the game, but he was the most successful artist of his generation, in his lifetime, but then got bored with it and said, you know what? I don't want to do this. I want to be much more abstract. And he really was the first impressionist before there was a word called impressionists. And people started, his most famous paintings now, people were sending them back and refusing to pay him. And it bankrupted him. But he felt compelled. This is what I want. I don't want to do. I don't want to be Rembrandt that everyone knows. I want to do this now. You know? And it makes no marketing sense. But from our point of view, he pushed art, the envelope of art, and broke those rules. And that allowed the people to come in behind him and break the rules a bit more.
You're hurting my brain a little bit right now.
Our art form is totally littered with those people as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. So look at Tom Joyce and Albert Paley. They broke the rules.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? They broke away from the traditional designs of what was traditional, you know? And a lot of those traditional blacksmiths were doing beautiful work, and it's fantastic to see. But then all of a sudden you got a new generation of young pups come along and said, oh, I'm going to kick that to the curb. I can do that.
Yeah.
Now I want to, now like Albert Paley and his, you know, like everyone I think is inspired by this, his experiment in twists and how much you stress you can put a bar under by twisting it. Just those little weird experiments and stuff like that that he was doing and then throwing into his work. And we've grown up, you and I have known that from day one being in the forge, but that must have been astonishing in the 60s and 70s to see somebody doing that with metal.
Right. You know? Yeah, for sure.
And like a lot of the that generation in the 60s and 70s, they weren't that well liked by some of the older traditional blacksmiths. So it's the same with music. It's the same with poetry. It's the same with filmmaking. You'll get an establishment that established themselves and wants to control everything, and then you'll get the young pups come in and they will kick the doors down and everything will get reinvigorated, and then they become the establishment and try to stop anybody else doing what they did, and eventually you get that that groundswell of water that it's going to break.
We're borderlining on politics here.
Yeah, but you can't get away from that, though. But it's the politics of endeavor rather than the politics of man. It's endeavor. And you can't get away from that because we're involved in that area of politics. If you're trying to do something, eventually you're going to come across somebody and your work is offensive to them because you're not doing it the way their dad told them to do it.
Oh,
could be just make it the way you make tongs.
You know, it could be just the equipment you use in your shop, and people will scoff at you for it. It's brutal. But hey,
the amount of times I've had blacksmiths come into the forge and get upset by seeing how little equipment I have in my forge, and it's like forging stuff by hand kind of offends people.
Or the other way around. Oh, you're using machinery? You're not a real blacksmith.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, no, this is your imagination, and you work the way you want to do. Like, I know, because I was into traditional techniques, and I still am to a large extent into traditional techniques, people used to think I was a Puritan. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm not a Puritan about it. This is how I want to work. But I'm interested in the way you're working because you're working different to me. And maybe there's something I can get from that. But just because I want to use tenons and collar work and fire welding and rivets doesn't mean I'm not interested in what you're doing with laser cutting and TIG welding. Mm-hmm. Like, that to me is really fascinating. And I might want to use that at some point. But, you know, I'm not discounting what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, totally. It's just that I've got my approach. But I'm not saying my approach is right. It's just my approach. You know, and you'll learn things from all sorts of unusual areas if you allow yourself to stray that way. Yeah. Which is it's not how the modern world is set up now. No. The modern world is set up for us to be told this is the way they are done.
Yeah.
And if you don't say this, you'll fail your exam.
Yeah.
And it's like, I love the people that said, fuck the exam. This is what I'm going to do. Like, you know, like the world is built on people that left, that were dropouts from college or didn't even go to college.
Yeah.
I had a curator in once into the forge, and she came in to maybe have the idea of giving me an exhibition at a gallery. And she came in. And I had this one particular sculpture and she couldn't keep her hands off it. And all the time she's like running her hands over the sculpture, telling me that I'm not really an artist because I didn't go to art college. So I was just like, oh, right. Okay.
Oh, geez.
And then I kind of got a talk. I knew what was coming next. I could see what was coming next. So I got a talk in, and there was an exhibition in Dublin at the time of, I don't know whether you've ever heard of Lucian Freud, and he's like a famous painter, and he died a few years before this, and there was an exhibition of his work in Dublin. And so she got onto the subject, I've just come from the Lucian Freud exhibition, and I said, oh well, he wasn't an artist. And she said, well, of course he was. And she was like offended, and I said, no, he didn't have an art degree. And so then she changed it to Francis Bacon, and I said, yeah, he didn't have an art degree either. And literally she went through about 10 artists, and not one of them had an art degree. And then she, well, I don't have time to waste here with you. And she left and never heard from her again. And I just laughed so much. I laughed so much afterwards.
That art degree does something for people though, man. I've noticed that in the world of blacksmiths, there's a few people out there that have these art degrees, and those people that have art degrees have a connection to that art world more so than the people that don't, which helps
the network.
Them. Yeah, the network. Totally,
the
dude.
Network. You learn a network and you meet people. I've been saying this for years. We need to get forge work into art schools because not all of those people studying art become artists. They become curators. They become people that work for Google and commission artworks. So if we're not present in the art schools, they don't know to commission blacksmiths.
Interesting.
You know, but that art form is not present. So we should be there. We should be in more. There are quite a few art colleges that have forge work as part of their curriculum.
Yeah.
But I know the most famous one at the moment, or the one that seems to be really leading the way at the moment, is in Sweden. You know, I don't know whether you've heard of it, the Gothenburg University, their metal division is churning out some really interesting people and interesting work. Trailblazers.
Yeah, I follow some Swedish educational blacksmithing page. I know for sure, but I don't think it's that one. This man, the Swedes pump out some gnarly stuff, dude.
Oh yeah. Well, it's that thing, you know, like every nation has its own particular.
Yeah.
Way of looking at life, and it kind of puts you on a slant. So you'll see that design ethic pushes through, you know, for different. I think, you know, when you move country, when you move to another country, you have this, you have a different perspective on your own country, and also you've moved to another country, and everyone goes through the phases. You know, it's like that phases of grief, you know, and it's denial. And then, but so you move to a country and first off, you're in love with everything. Everything is great because it's all new. Then you start to get really fucking pissed off with the stupid little things. Yeah, and then you come through that and you can be a little bit more objective, but you know, and then you move on to another part of it, which is acceptance. You accept the fact that that's just the way things happen in this country. You know, but you can look at I can look at Britain now and look at it with a cold eye because I've lived here for so long. And I think everyone should live in a different country for at least 2 years of their life.
Yeah, it does something for you for sure, man.
Yeah, you kind of, and then you can start seeing, like, I see the design decisions people make here in Ireland, and it's really interesting. It's fascinating to me because they have a different way of looking at it. And I've seen that in Canada. I've seen it in Germany, and I've seen it in Russia. The different cultural markers that they're putting into their work is really interesting.
You've been pretty lucky. You've traveled a lot with your blacksmithing, like you said, Canada, Russia. Been all over the place. And okay, so I hate to take away from that because I'd like to hear more about that, but we brought up music a little bit ago. We were talking about your tools. I'd like to get back to that as well. But real quick, music. I threw out King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. Go check out Iron Lung by King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. Amazing song. What's a song that you could throw out on the playlist for everybody to go check out? Something that's on the list.
I'm trying to remember the name of the fucking song now, but it's a Clash record. Like, I'm a big Clash fan.
Like, I love the Clash, dude.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there's one that I can't remember the name of it for the life of me at the moment, but when it comes on in the Forge, it's like the ultimate let's forge some shit, like, song.
That's sweet, dude.
It will come back to me in a minute. I'm like, this is the thing. I'm terrible with names of songs and all sorts. And that, okay, but Clash and like Ian Dury and the Blockheads and stuff like that, like, because I grew up with it. I was a kid when the whole punk thing happened in England, and it kind of was a big thing for me. And then the whole ska movement that kind of followed it in. There was a whole punk ska movement in the UK. So Madness and Specials and
yes,
and all of that. So you know, I love all of that. And I love I love stuff from the 90s as well. You know, like, you know, you grow up and you go through phases and stuff. But I do come back to the Clash an awful lot and bands like that. I love that. It's great music in the Forge. The Clash are great to have in the Forge.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man. I love my ska, dude. Mad Caddies is, like, super hot on my playlist. I love the Mad Caddies. They're a band from California. They're a ska band. Right. They've come to Winnipeg a few times, and I've seen them live. I think 5 times now, at least, I've gone to see them live. Just awesome every time. Yeah, but definitely they've probably had every one of their songs used in a snowboarding or skateboarding video at this point. It's good stuff for sure. And I've been huge on the Specials. What's some other ones from the UK that I've been huge on? The Specials, for sure. I've always liked the Specials.
I can remember I must have been about 10 years old when Ghost Town came out, and it was like a bomb dropping in my school. That song came out, and going to the school disco, you know, and everyone wanted to dress like them or dress like Madness. And so there was everybody with the Stay Press trousers on and loafers and Fred Perry t-shirts, and like, it was just like, it was a whole art movement, a dance movement,
a two-tone movement.
It was just fucking huge. Like, literally everyone, I had to beg my mum to let me have a Fred Perry t-shirt and a pair of Stay Press. I had to refuse to leave the house. That was the only she'd brought tickets for a circus, right? And little did she know, because I never said anything, I hated circuses anyway. But I said, oh, I'm not going. Do you want to go? I'm not going out in, like, I had flares on. And I was like, all my friends had Stay Press on. And I just, I said, I'm not going out of the house anymore until I get a pair of Stay Press, you know. So it was the only time, usually I'd get a good clip around the ear for stuff like that. But I think maybe one of my older sisters kind of said, ah, look, he's a bit embarrassing, Mum, you know, because she was, you ever see those, you know, you'll see it in the 70s films with the frilly front of the shirt that used to button on to the shirt. And a velvet bow tie. That's how what my mum used to dress me like for family parties and that. And I was into ska music and punk music, and happened to go out dressed like that. And I was like, oh, Jesus. And then, of course, the ribbon you get from your friends as well when you turn up at school in your flares, brown flares, you know, nylon brown flares. And I think I still had platform shoes. My mum had brought me these platform shoes that were the most uncomfortable shoes I've ever worn in my life.
You missed the era, bud.
Jesus. So anyway, I got my Stay Press. And weird thing was, the guy who lived across the road was a lorry driver, and he got a load of Converse, like...
Would you call him a lorry driver?
A lorry driver, truck driver.
Oh, crazy. Never heard that term
before.
We call
them lorries. Yeah, we used to call them lorries when I was a kid, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
So he was like a long-distance truck driver. And I don't know that, you know, truck drivers were the great people to know because there was always stuff that fell off the back of their truck. So I got a pair of blue Converse, like, boots, and I just thought they were the best thing ever. And I remember being so chuffed with them, you know? And, I was just a little kid at the time. Must have been about 8 or 9.
Let's go back to the shop tools, buddy. You're talking about the press fit pants, and we were talking about the fly press.
Perfect
time to, you know, actually, you know what? Talking about shop tools, this is a really good time to bring up Maritime Knife Supply. I don't know if you're familiar with Maritime Knife Supply and Lawrence Lake over at Maritime Knife Supply, but Lawrence is the leader of the game when it comes to knife supplies in Canada, in North America. You need anything, dude. I'm talking sanding belts. We're talking powdered steel and high carbon steels, all of the different knife steels you could possibly want. He carries all of that stock in-house, quick shipping, extremely quick shipping, faster than you'll get from anybody else, essentially. And the prices are unbeatable. You can use the code FSCKILN at checkout. You'll save yourself $100
on Even Heat and Paragon Kilns, that is.
Head on over to maritimeknifesupply.ca. And don't forget, there are 10 packs of belts. You get that for the price of 9. That's a free belt with every order of a 10-pack. Go check them out, maritimeknifesupply.ca. So, tools, dude. You've got the fly. We mentioned you got the fly press. What do you got for an anvil?
I've got 3 anvils in the forge. I've got a 100 kg... German anvil, which was from, there's not a make on it. It's a really cool anvil. My friend Bill got it for me. And it was another one where I just did work for his neighbor. His neighbor really liked my fire sets. So I made him 2 fire sets and he sent over this 100 kg, or it's actually 89 kg anvil from, it was made in 1889. And there's the face of the god Janus stamped on it. And the German blacksmith was saying that's very traditional, like, because the Janus was the god of gateways, and he's looking both forwards and backwards. And so it was what Germans put on their anvils, was the double face. It's like a two-headed god. And so that's on the side of the anvil. It's very faint now because the anvil's old, but it's a nice wrought iron anvil. It's beautiful. So I've got that. That's a double bit, like southern German pattern anvil. And then I've got a London pattern anvil, which is it's another German make. It's a Reflinghaus, which my wife's parents bought me when I set up my own forge. They bought it for me, and it's got the date stamped on it, the year that I started my forge. So that's cool.
Oh, that's awesome, dude.
I've got a little anvil, a little pedding house anvil that I use for when I'm doing demos, because I can just lift it up, put it in the back of the van. But that's in my wife's workshop here at the house. So she uses that. I just borrow it now. And then, and that one was given to me, actually. That anvil, that pedding house was given to me. And then I've got the steak anvil that I told you about that my friend Bill gave me. Another beautiful anvil. Literally, I don't think anyone had ever done any work on it. Even though it's over like 100 years old, I don't think anyone
did any work. How do you have that mounted?
I've got it just mounted into a stump.
Nice.
So I put all my anvils on oak stumps.
Oh yeah.
Because they deaden the sound beautifully.
Yeah.
And it's so stable. So I've got a local woodyard, and I just go to him. And the beauty of the thing with something like oak is it just gets harder every year, so you get more and more return. I think it takes about 15 years for oak to fully harden. So at this stage, that anvil stump is fully hardened on those two anvils.
Do you do anything to fasten it down to the stump?
I made stakes.
Yeah.
You know, so I did upset cornered stakes out of 20 mil bar, which is just under an inch bar I used to make the stakes for them. And then that really weights it down to that. And then I get the stumps cut square to the footprint of the foot of the anvil. So that you can, because otherwise, you know, like the blacksmith I trained with, Brian, he used to have these big round stumps, but you couldn't step into the anvil. And then also it meant that there was loads of wood in the way when you're working on the horn of the anvil and you need to get under the horn. You've got a big lump of wood in the way. But also you're stood way too back. Sometimes you have to step into the anvil. You're working over the edge or around the horn, you have to step into the anvil. So if you get the stump made to the footprint of the anvil, you've got that room.
That's what I do.
If I buy a new anvil, that's the first thing I do is go and get an anvil, a stump cut for the woodyard.
That's the big problem that I've been playing around with, big scenario that I've played around with quite a bit, different anvil stands. And I've had a lot of people tell me that the best anvil stand you can go for is the tri-leg style anvil stand.
Yeah, I've seen that. I've never used one, but I've seen them.
They are really nice. They're easier to move around because just the three legs can slide easily on cement, depending on the size of anvil you've got on it, right? If you have, like, I've got almost a 400-pound anvil that I put on top of one just recently, and yeah, it doesn't slide that easily. But the problem is because it's such a heavy anvil, it's a little top heavy. But that's why I moved away from stumps as well, is because I found that you have that big of an anvil on a stump and it gets top heavy. I have my main daily driver. I mounted it to a pyramid shaped box that I made, four sided pyramid.
Right, Did you fill it with sand and
The problem that comes up with that, exactly what you're saying with the large stump, I can't get my footing close enough. So I've been playing with the idea back and forth with a few different people. And I think for me, the style of anvil stand that I'm starting to really think, in my mind anyways, is the best is that pyramid style, but to make cutouts on the floor that your foot can fit underneath of the box still. And then... box in the bottom plate of the box. It boxes in the box and holds all the sand in place. You need to give yourself about a 2 to 3 inch gap underneath the anvil for your foot to be able to fit under the anvil.
All right, yeah, like kind of similar to the foot of the old of the you know the Italian side anvils. The big anvils.
I've seen.
There's the old the Brooks anvils out of England. They used to come with a cast stand where it had the same thing.
Yep,
I've got a big Brooks swage block which has the original casting.
That's sweet to have.
Well, it came with an interesting story as well. A guy just phoned me up and he said, "Oh, I've got a swage block here and an anvil, and they were my granddad's, and I want to sell them to somebody who's going to use them before someone steals them." And I said, oh, that's good. And I said, I'll come down and have a look. So I went out. He was in Galway, this fella. And I went out to Galway. And this anvil was massive. It was way too big for me. And I never really liked the Brooks anvils that much. They were too chunky, you know.
I gotta go, bud. It was nice talking to you.
You know what I mean? It's the heel of the anvil.
I love it. I love how chunky it is. Thick for me. How it should be.
But so I didn't want the anvil, but I wanted the the swage block, and it's huge. This swage block is huge. And I said, yeah, I want it. And I said, but I wasn't lying. All I had was 250 euros. That's all I had. And he was like, ah, Jesus, I wanted 400 euros for that. And I said, look, I understand. I said, I'll send the word out to blacksmith friends. I'm sure you'll get somebody come in and they'll pick both of them up, you know. And
yeah.
I'm glad I came down to look at it. And I was turning to leave. He said, you know what? He said, you can have it for 250 because I know you'll use it and my granddad would want it to be used.
Buddy.
Ah, Jesus. And that's what I was saying to you about being open and honest with people.
Yep.
Sometimes you can lose stuff, you know? But yeah, it was great. But he was telling me that his granddad brought it in 1940. And it was shipped from London all the way round the coast of Scotland, round onto the west coast, into Galway Harbour. And he went down with his horse and cart and picked these up. They're massive.
Oh,
they're absolutely massive. This anvil is huge. It's like it's 300-400 pound anvil.
And you didn't want it?
It had a bit of a chunk missing out of the face. Okay. So I didn't want to have to repair it. I prefer the Southern German pattern anvils. I think they're much more adaptable and nicer to work on.
Like double horn or?
Yeah, double horn, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I prefer those. I prefer double horn anvils.
Fair enough.
And so I knew the other thing is, you know, if you know it's just going to sit in your forge and gather dust, that to me is a bit of a sin. If you've got tools that are just sitting there and you're never going to use it in a million years,
like, stop it.
I would have ended up putting it on the floor as an upsetting block.
Dude, okay. You know? Literally, we can't. I'm going to have to leave right away. This is enough. I'm not here hurting my feelings.
They're good anvils. I'm not knocking the Brooks as they've got good return on them. They're a good anvil. I'm not knocking
them. Well, and this whole hoarding tools and not using them thing. Like, come on now, take off, you hoser.
I've struggled to find tools so much, and I hate the idea of having something in my forge that somebody else would get really good use out of.
Well, I've come to notice something, though, is that I think the market's changed. The forged and fire craze has died down. There has been a handful of anvils on Marketplace in my area over a month now. I've seen these same anvils. We'll say 2 years ago, those anvils wouldn't have lasted on Marketplace for more than an hour.
Yeah.
It's changed.
You know, I love those people. I love the people that follow trends and jump on a bandwagon because God love them. They're going to pay top dollar for that equipment
in a few years' time.
Some lucky bastard's going to pick it up for a fraction of the price from them because they are no longer interested in that. Now I'm into tiddlywinks. Yeah. You know? I'm no longer going to be a swordsmith.
Well, and I heard somebody else, they had a very good way of doing it, is they would sell their anvils and tools and whatnot to other people at a very reasonable rate with the stipulation that if you ever decide that you're not going to use this tool anymore, contact me and I will buy it back from you for the price that you paid for it. So.
Yeah. And I was the first time I came over to Canada and I went up to Cape Breton, the Cape Breton Blacksmith Association invited me over. They had a thing called Forge 300. It was a couple of years before they had Can Iron X.
Okay.
They had Lorelei.
Lorelei Sims.
Lorelei Sims and Oh God, he's going to kill me for not remembering his name now. It's just slipped out of my fucking head. But anyway, it was a great forging, and there was lots of local blacksmiths there, and a few people from America came up. It was a great event. But we were sat there. We were sat eating lobsters. We were in this restaurant, sat eating lobsters, yeah. And I was chatting to this guy. He was an amazing guy, and everyone called him Doug the Tug because he was a tugboat captain.
Nice. And,
there was a young lad there who was must have been 18, and he'd never had any experience forging. Norrie, Dave Norrie was the other master blacksmith there, right? This guy turns up at this event just because he had an interest in forge work. The next day, he's tending fire for Dave Norrie during his live demo.
No.
And I was sat there chatting to Doug, and we invited this young lad out for dinner with us. It was like, like every forging will have a meal for the masters or whatever. And we said to this young lad, look, you know, you're in the same motel as us. Why don't you come out for this meal? So he sat there with Lorelei Sims and Dave Norrie, and he's chatting away to them. And I said to the Doug, I said, if he really gets into forge work, this won't hit him for another 10 years, how lucky he was.
Yeah.
And Doug said, you know, what do you think of this young lad then, Mike? I said, oh, he seems like a nice fellow. I said, I like him. And he said, do you have an anvil? He said to this fella. And he said, no. And he said, well, he said, when we get back to the motel tonight, I've got one in the back of the truck. You can have it. So this young lad walked away with an anvil for free. Doug just gave it to him. He was bringing it to meet the right young person to give it to, because he didn't need it. It was too small for him. No, I just loved that story. I loved it. I loved being part of that. And seeing that generosity that some people have.
I've definitely seen a few scenarios like that myself, and tried to help people out when I can too, man. It's nice to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. And not always you're in a position to do that, but but sometimes you're in the position to do something. Sometimes it's just your time, giving someone an encouraging word, you know, or just having a chat to them, or showing them something, you know. And I think it's an important thing to bear in mind. And it's not for everyone. Some people just want to get their head down, get on with their work, and that's fine. You know, that's fine as well. I appreciate whenever somebody has spent the time to talk to me or share something with me. You know, my whole life I've appreciated that. So I try to pass that on. You know, sometimes you're just like, oh, Jesus. I've got so much to do, you know, but I tried to stop myself and say, well, hold on a minute. This was you 10 years ago, you know, just give this guy or this woman a few minutes of your time and explain that technique to them.
Yep. You know? Funny that you say that. I'm dealing with that right now. There's a gentleman that bought an anvil off of me, and he's been bugging me left, right, and center about how to do heat treatments on he's trying to make knives. And he's telling me about what he's doing. He's using a torch to heat it up, to do a edge quenching, and then trying to do an edge temper or something. And I'm like, some of these terms you're using don't make any sense to me, man. And I'm completely lost at what you're trying to ask me here. I think maybe as much as I'd like to offer you as advice and stuff, you might need to take a step back and go read a couple books or go watch some YouTube videos here.
I just give them a list of books.
That's exactly what I did.
Buy these books, because
so I told the guy, go watch Walter Sorrell's on YouTube, and you will learn everything you need to know about knives. You know what he responded to me to? He said, LOL, Walter Sorrell is an author. All right. Well, I tried to help.
There's only so much you can do for somebody. If you can lead people that want to be led, but you can't make somebody.
Oh, it's the saying, my favorite saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you still need a stepladder to fuck it in the ass.
Yeah.
Are you cool if we take a 2-minute break? I just want to go fill up a cup of coffee here. I'm super thirsty right now.
Yeah, sure. That's no problem. Yeah.
Awesome, buddy. Thank you very much. We'll just pause it and I'll be right back with you.
You're welcome.
All right. Are you cool if we dive back to the tools again? We were.
Yeah, sure. Wherever you want to take it, yeah.
You're telling me about the anvils that you've got, and sounds like you've got a nice little collection of anvils. And
You kind of always want more, though, don't you?
Well,
even though I don't want a board, there's always anvils you've got, yeah.
It's oddly enough that you say that I've been starting a collection of small anvils lately because I had somewhat collecting large anvils and I got to a point where I was like, it's too much, man. I just don't have the room for all these anvils. I need the real estate in my shop. And again, another thing you brought up is there's people out there that need them, man. So
yeah. And the more we can encourage people into the craft, the more work there is for all of us, because the more people come in contact with it.
Yeah.
You know, so we need people. We need the new entrants into forge work. We need people coming in and spreading the word, you know? And so those tools are important to those people, because that can be what puts somebody off, you know, is not having access to tools, because we've all been in that situation where we haven't had the right tool for the job and it's been really frustrating.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And so, and then you get to a point of your career where you just have the right tool for that job and everything goes so quick and so smooth because you turn around, I've got the right tool for that. And when you start off the career, everyone's in the position where you don't have the right tooling and you're making do with this mad thing. You know, and it's like, oh Jesus.
Yeah, you're making my brain spin big time right now, because that's exactly what I was thinking about, is all the things that I've done to make it work when I didn't have the right tool. And then when you get the right tool, it's just like, this is so much easier now.
Yeah, and it's like a luxury. So why wouldn't you, if you can?
What are some of the tools you have that have done that for you, that have been game changers?
Well, not so much the power hammer, because I knew I obviously worked with power hammers before that, but like the fly press was quite a big game changer. Being able to set it up and just cut in the shoulders of a tenon, and you know, like cold bend steel, you know, those type of things were really useful. Like I get restoration work in, and you've got rivets that some blacksmith made 100 years ago, and they're not something you can buy, wrought iron rivets that with that size of a head on it. So you have to make it. And so it's much easier to make a tool for the fly press and make those rivets under the fly press, you know? And those type of things. So the fly press was a big game changer. And then I was going to say the drill press, when I got the drill press, because the first three, four years I had the forge, I didn't have a drill press. And so everything had to be hot punched. No, I haven't got a geared. I've got a belt driven one. I'm still looking for a geared one. But for the first 3-4 years, I was hot punching everything.
Oh no.
It's still my go-to. I got so used to it, but it's still my go-to. Hot punching is still my go-to with a lot of things.
No way.
Unless I'm doing like a long, you know, I've got 20 holes in a length of something for a railing or whatever, then I'll put it under the drill press, or I get the mag drill out and just work along it. But I will still hot punch as much as I can.
Really?
And that's why I want to get the number 6, because it's got enough weight behind it to hot punch for making hammers. And so that's the idea, is to get one of those and tool up. And then I don't make that many hammers, but every now and again somebody will ask me to make one, and I'll make one. And then I'm punching it by hand still.
Make a hammer, are you focusing on trying to reproduce the exact same hammer every time, or do you just Are you kind of a little bit, I think, is whimsical the right word to use when it comes to that? A little bit?
Well, I think there's a, I think when you're doing repeats of something and they're not, it's not a factory process repeat where you've got to make 50 of these this month. You know, when it's like you're making maybe, let's say on average you're making one a month, then there's going to be, or I think there should be, an organic process to your design.
Okay.
So something will occur to you while you're making this hammer, and then the next time you think, I'll try that, and it works. And you kind of like the way that looks it now. And so you try that out and you do that for a few years, and then all of a sudden something else. So there should be a progression in your work, I think. As long as it still functions as a hammer. I've got no time for things that you're putting a design in there for the sake of a design, and it's not actually helping the function of the hammer, or it's hindering the function of the hammer.
Well,
but I think
okay,
there's room there for an organic process of your development.
And the reason I ask that is, it's very much similar in line to what you're saying, is at one point in my development, I made a crosspin hammer, and then a year later I made another crosspin hammer. Not, they don't look similar to each other other than the fact that they're crosspins. They both function as crosspins, but the basic aesthetics of the style of hammer is very different from one to the other. Would, as somebody who's making a hammer, do you think it's wrong to go about doing that? I'm trying to think of the best way to go about that. If somebody is to order a hammer from me and they're expecting to get a custom-made hammer, they don't really know what they're getting, because I don't advertise a specific style of hammer or anything like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if somebody was to order a hammer from me and they got something and they were to like, well, this isn't what I was expecting. I was expecting it to look like your last hammer. And it's like, well, compare it to the hammer before that, how did you feel about, or what about the hammer before that? Because, you know, you look at the lineage of my hammers and there's not really an exact style that they all fall into. Each one of them is different. Is that something that I should avoid doing as a hammer maker? Is it acceptable?
I think it depends if you're if you're somebody who has become very well known for making hammers. Is, let's say if you're Brent Bailey, and they want a Brent Bailey style, German style forging hammer, and that's what they order from you, they better be getting that. But if you're somebody just says, man, I love your hammers, would you make me one? And they're not specifying, I want it to be exactly like this. And if you're not totally moving the envelope every time, so not trying to reinvent the fucking wheel every single time. So you, like I say, it's an organic process. You know, the scallops, you're putting a scallop into a hat, into the side of the anvil or whatever this time. And next time you want it slightly deeper. Yeah, it's a slightly different design, but someone can see the lineage there. I don't think they'd have a problem. I've never had a problem with that. No one's ever come back to me and said, Jesus, that's not the hammer you made the last time. The hammers I make now are totally different to what I was making 10 years ago.
Okay, there you go. And the reason I ask that is it's something that I've questioned myself. I mean, I've fallen into a scenario with that, but I also, because of that, have sat back and questioned myself, what does a hammer from me look like? If I was to offer a line of hammers, what would I want it to look like? I'm not even too sure what I want my hammer, if I was to produce a hammer that a whole bunch of people are going to be buying the exact same hammer, I'm not even really too sure what I would want it to look like. It's, you know, and at that point is kind of where I step back and went, well, wait a minute, maybe hammers isn't my thing. Maybe it's not what I want to be making. And if it's not what I want to be making, should I be worrying about these these one-off hammers even taking those orders, or should I just focus on what I want to focus on and do that, right?
Well, there's two sides to this story. Firstly, you need to focus on what interests you, because you're going to develop that a lot better than you will anything else, or you'll be more interested, you'll be more involved in that process. But the beauty of commission work, especially when you've been in the boat I'm in all the time, where you can't afford to turn work down, is it pushes you into areas that you might not have taken yourself, and you will learn something from that process, which will inform the rest of your work. And you could find something that you're reluctant to do at first, but you end up loving. And that's a personal choice, isn't it? But I think there's a trade-off, but there's also a payback involved in that process of taking a commission. So, like, we all want to be in that position where we can do what the fuck we like. Someone's just saying, I want one of your, like, my ideal scenarios is somebody just coming to me and just saying, look, you know, I've got a stupid amount of money here and I want one of your sculptures. Will you just make something for me? That's the ideal scenario. The truth of it is you're dealing with a committee of people who's commissioning you to make a public sculpture somewhere, and they want it to incorporate X, Y, and Z into the design. And you're like, oh, Jesus, how am I going to do that and still do something that I find interesting? And it pushes you into an area. It pushes you to do something that you wouldn't do by yourself. And sometimes those can be the most interesting pieces you'll do, and you can learn the most from it. Sometimes it can lead you down the path of just doing the same boring old shit time and time again, because that's what the customers want. And there's plenty of artists out there that I won't name. I'm not talking about blacksmiths, but I'm talking about, like, you know, artists who basically been doing the same design for 40 years, but they're being paid millions to do that fucking whatever, you know, that ceramic bowl that they've been doing for 20 years, but it sells. And I knew a ceramicist, and he was doing the same thing. Everyone knew his work and knew what, you know, when you were buying a piece of his, this is what it looked like. And then he decided, you know what, I don't want to do that. I want to do these bright orange glazes and these new things. He didn't sell one of the pieces, and it was the best work he ever did, and he didn't sell one of them because they weren't a whatever his name was, you know. And so you've got to be careful, because you can, if you're going to just chase the money, then you can be led down that path, and then all of a sudden you get to being 20 years in the business and you're doing something you fucking detest. But no one will buy anything else from you.
Dude, I keep nailing it, man.
I think, but then some people are happy with that.
Yeah.
You're just looking, like, it's that Irish saying, isn't it? When someone stops and asks for directions and the guy says, well, I wouldn't start from here if I was you, if I was trying to get there. And it's like, it's the same with business. You've got to decide what you want. If making money is your major concern, then probably coming up with a good design and getting it mass produced somewhere, and like that is, you know, that is a Lando hammer, you know, and you've designed it and you've developed it, and then you get some company in India to fucking whack them out for you for a fiver a piece, and you sell them for $100 a piece. That's a good,
man.
That's making money. So you've got to decide, do you want to be a good blacksmith and be interested in your work, or do you want to be rich?
Yeah.
Because that definitely, you've got much better chance of being rich the other way than following your heart.
That's, I realize that. You know, I definitely realize that, man.
Not that I'm trying to put people off, because I just do, I've been spending the last 20 years following my heart. And I always encourage people to do it. I'm just saying the realities are that the people that are making really, with the exception of people like Albert Bailey, the people that are making the really, really good money tend to be people where, in the art world, where everyone knows what they're getting.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. If you buy a front, like, have you ever been to Toronto Airport?
Right.
And
yeah.
seen the Frank Sierra sculpture at the, as you walk into the International Lounge, there's a Frank Sierra sculpture there.
And it's, not too sure. I don't remember.
I don't know whether you've ever heard of Frank Sierra. He does these massive Corten steel plate sculptures that you walk through. They're huge.
Okay.
You know? They're up, you know, upwards of 10 foot tall. Nice. And they're huge, great. And he bends them and they're beautiful. But if you've seen one Frank Sierra sculpture, you've seen them all. I'm in awe of that work. You know? But there's only so many ways you can bend a piece of Corten steel, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're making me think of Vivian Beer. Somebody.
Yeah, but she's doing a lot of different things with her. She's got depth to her work, I think.
That's why I brought her up, because you look at her work and it's not necessarily like, oh, that piece is that piece and this piece is this, like, there are vast differences in her work for sure.
There are, but you know, you do know when you've seen a piece of her work, but she has depth to her work that I don't think the type of artists I'm talking about, they don't have that depth that Vivian has. But then if you look at Tom Joyce's, if you picked one decade and then went, skip forward 10 years with Tom Joyce, I don't think you'd say, well, that's a Tom Joyce. If you see the stuff he's doing now compared to what he was doing 20 years ago, I don't think you'd necessarily say they were the same person. He's managed to make a good career out of that, and his work is phenomenal. You know,
who is that?
Phenomenal work. Tom Joyce.
I don't think I follow that name. Tom Joyce.
You won't find him on social media.
Ah, okay.
You'll have to go get a book. You'll see a few photographs on Instagram of his work that other people have put up, or a gallery. I think he's West Coast America originally.
Okay.
I don't know where he's based at the moment, because it was the big thing. It was him on the West Coast and Albert Paley on the East.
Yeah, okay, okay.
The two colossus of American forge work in many ways.
I've looked at Albert Paley's work and I understand. There's a certain level of understanding that I have when it comes to his work that I think a lot of people don't look at, that in order to obtain the ability to do that work, you have to have a very large infrastructure behind you of tooling and a large shop
and this is the thing we've got to address here, is you've got to have the client base.
Well, yes.
The Smithsonian Museum without the money being there to make the gates for the Smithsonian Museum.
Well, and you won't have the infrastructure without the money either. That's what I'm getting at.
Take tooling out of it. Take tooling out of it, right?
Okay.
Who's going to pay you to work on something for a year? How can you afford to work on one project, excluding everything else, for a year? Right, that is a lot of money just to you, to sustain you and your family, and to pay the bills of your forge. Right, you want to work on one project for a year. You've got to get the client base for that. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. You're going to be You're going to be robbing time from the bread and butter. In order to work on that thing where you can do exactly what you want to do.
But that comes with a level of expectation as well. What do you expect out of life? Somebody might be willing to put a year's worth of effort into something and never make a freaking dime from it. You know, project.
Lando, you've got to afford it.
That's why I say, like, a lot of it comes down to the infrastructure, because something like Albert Paley's stuff, for example, regardless of how much time you have, you're not going to be able to make something like that unless you invest in the machinery to do it.
No,
and you can't invest in the machinery unless you have the money. Whereas when it comes to...
You can with basic hand tools, if you gave if you gave like a gifted or somebody had developed their skills and they were gifted, if you gave them a year in a workshop with an anvil, a leg vise, hammers, tongs, just basic tooling, right? A year, they could do something amazing. And you say, look, we're just going to give you this workshop. We want you to do an amazing piece for us. It doesn't have to be the monumental scale. No. It could be quite small, but you're spending that time developing the idea, working out what works, getting it to the point where you're happy with it, and being able to, the value of being able to focus on one thing every single day is a big gift to give somebody. That's a massive gift. That's what people are giving you when they're investing in your artwork or your craft work or whatever you want to put it. That allows you to develop the next idea. And so if you're coming to somebody, to an artist, and, you know, it's advice I would give to billionaires is, this is how you approach an artist. You see a work, you see an artist and you like their work and you go to them, I want you to make something for me. This is where it's going. This is the budget I have. Are you happy with that? And then walk away. I'll see you in a year's time. That's the biggest gift you could give to somebody. Imagine someone coming into your forge and saying, here's $250,000, Lando. I want this to go in my garden. And I like your work. Do something for me. And then walking away and you don't hear from him for a year. Like, imagine what you could do with that, even with your tooling as it is now.
Well, okay. So there's a side to that that I agree with so much. 110%, I so much agree with everything you said, that's the dream, dude. That is the dream for somebody like you and me, for a guy to walk up and be like, here's an exponential amount of money, go and build. But what is an exponential amount of money is partially what I was trying to bring up with to you and me. $250,000 to work for a year, that are, wow, dude, that's awesome. Yeah, somebody like Albert Paley, though. $250,000 to work for? Yeah, are you fucking taking a piss at me, buddy?
I was saying Albert Payne calls it. He calls his forge the beast. I think something like that, because he has to feed it. It's like a monster. He has to feed.
Yeah,
he has people that their mortgages are being paid.
Exactly. You know? Totally.
And that's the responsibility that he has. And it costs a lot more money to run his workshop than ours.
So you
have to fuel that system. So like,
the
you're
overhead,
right.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what, when I say the infrastructure, it's the overhead of what does it cost me to actually do my work? Somebody could sit at an anvil with a hammer and a forge almost for pennies on the day and still be able to produce an absolutely amazing sculpture piece. Whereas somebody like Albert Paley, there's no way they have the ability to do that, because just to be able to buy some of the machinery requires ton of money, and if you aren't making a ton of money, you'll never have that machinery.
But this is where the idea of creativity and artwork comes in, okay? Because, I'm trying to think of an example to pull out here, but like, we take music, right? You have access to a symphony. A symphonic orchestra. How much money does that afford you? Does that mean that your work is going to be any better than that fella sat in his bedroom at home?
Exactly what I'm saying, man.
You know, it means that it's going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody came into my workshop and offered me 20,000 to do a sculpture, that would be fucking a massive amount of money.
Uh-huh.
And it would afford me months to work on that job, you know?
Right.
And then the
work,
there's nothing lesser about the work that I might produce than somebody like Albert Paley, who has a big workshop and has a workforce. It's just that the monumental scale of his work can way outstrip what I'm doing. But think of some of the best artwork you can think of. you know, like, or I don't know who your favorite artists are. And even if you take
Albert Paley would never touch that style of artwork or be able to even produce that style because it's not within his realm of work.
Oh no, Jesus! I went to his lectures at Cannes INX, and there's a lot of stuff you don't see that he does. Small stuff that he does, private commissions and stuff like that.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, he's still doing. Like I remember once he was showing us all the. He was showing us all of the production photographs of stuff he does and stuff that doesn't get into books because it goes into private houses. And I say we, there was like, you know, 300 people in the room. it was astonishing some of the stuff he did. He was doing for people's private houses and stuff like that, candlestick holders.
Interesting.
Door handles. He did one, he showed us a series of photographs for a law office in Manhattan, and literally everything in this office was Albert Paley. The desks, lamps, the hinges and the door handles on the glass doors. Like, it was incredible. And then on the third day, it was like a series of three lectures, and on the third day it was there was like a 2-hour question and answer, and one guy got up and said, Albert, like, you showed us on day one the pictures of the law firm in Manhattan. How much did they pay for that? And he just turned around and said, a lot. It was like, they must have paid millions for this thing. It was incredible. It was absolutely incredible, the photographs he was telling. But those are the things you don't see.
Yeah.
You know, because they're not the big monumental stuff that makes it into they're not the public realm work of his that makes it into the books that look really impressive in the coffee table books, you know. Yeah. But I don't know, there's a national museum in Dublin, and it's full of, like, you know, 18th, 19th, 17th century paintings, and I find those museums can be a bit boring at times. And you go into the massive long galleries, you know, like these national museums have these massive long galleries. I went into this one gallery, and there was a painting at the bottom, and it was like someone firing a laser down the gallery. And you went past all these massive paintings, and you got down there, and it was about twice the size of a laptop screen, you know?
Okay.
So about 30 inches across, maybe, right? And it literally was firing a gun down this, and you thought, what's wrong with this painting? You went down there, and it was a Rembrandt. That's how good he was of an artist. There was paintings there that were like, you know, 6-foot by 8-foot canvases, and you couldn't even see them next to this small painting because he was that good at what he did. And so you can give somebody that small space. It's relevant to their vision. That's what that money is. It's, you can give somebody that, you can give someone 5,000 and they could produce something that potentially could knock the socks off of Albert Paley, no?
Yeah,
because
yeah.
That person is potentially doing something. They've got something in their head that we can't even guess at. You know, yeah.
Well, and their willingness to work for that amount of money versus not willing.
Well, their
it's
their willingness to want their work to come into the real world. Yeah. And you know yourself. Like, if you've got kids, you're willing to do fucking mad shit to make their lives a little bit better and progress their life from yours. You know, you're willing to go and do the shitty jobs. And I know my mum, like, you know, cleans toilets and stuff like that. And, you know, I think we all have those things where we've all,
owns her business is cleaning houses, dude. That's literally what my wife has been doing for the last 20 years of her life, is scrubbing people's toilets. And it's a shitty job per se, but it pays the bills. Like, she's doing damn good for herself right now.
Yeah. But I remember that there was an interview, and it was in the 60s, and they were interviewing the Beatles, and this guy asked John Lennon this question: is it easier is it harder now writing songs now that you're not poor anymore? And he said, no, he said, funny enough, it's a lot easier writing songs when you've got a nice soft chair to sit in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it opens up different avenues. There's this whole idea that you should suffer as an artist and like, I know all of that, like bollocks. But you know what? The world is full of great artists who came from all different types of backgrounds, you know? Yep. So you look at Byron, you know? He was a fucking lord, for fuck's sake. He was incredibly rich, but he wrote amazing poetry. Then you have Charles Bukowski, who, in my view, was a much better poet than Byron was, but he was a fucking postman, you know? And he's writing the maddest... I don't know if you've ever read any Bukowski stuff, but, like...
No.
You should check him out. He's an experience. There's a good documentary. I don't know whether it's still on Netflix, but there's a Charles Bukowski documentary. And I came away from it thinking, I don't really like this guy. But he's a fantastic, his work is fantastic. And he wrote a few scripts for films and stuff like that. And in fact, one of my favorite films, Barfly with Mickey Rourke, was written by Charles Bukowski.
And interesting.
He was just unapologetic. He was the person he was. And fuck everybody else. If you don't like it, you can go fuck yourself. He had that attitude. You know, and I kind of love that irreverence about him. But I don't think I'd like him as a human being. But like, work-wise...
It turns people off, I'll tell you what.
Well, this is the weird thing, Roz. You've got to watch the documentary. And you might not think... Because people loved him for it. They loved him for the fact that he was irreverent and he was a drinker and he wasn't the best looking fella. So all of a sudden in his 50s, he became a well-known poet and all of a sudden women were interested in him because he was all of a sudden a poet, you know? And it's that. So he was womanizing and he was doing all the things he couldn't do when he was younger because he was a postman and he wasn't particularly good looking and nobody he was mixing with was interested in poetry, you know? He comes from a very working class background. But my point is money and all that money allows you to do when you do the type of work we do is it gives you access to time.
Yeah.
You know? And if you can see that, in fact, if you take the Beatles as an example, you can see as they become more of a cash cow for EMI, they were given more time to produce that. At the moment, they started off 2 days, album's done.
Yeah.
And then they were given 6 months to do Sgt. Pepper's. And, you know, that breathing space that it gives you to develop those ideas and to say, and that's the same for everybody. If somebody turns around to you tomorrow and says, Lando, I've got 20 grand here, what sort of breathing space can that give you? And all of a sudden, you don't have to worry so much about paying the electricity bill this month. And you can spend a week developing that idea. It doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't matter. You can move on to the next idea.
Or you can be like Boston and completely freaking sink the band Boston.
But you know what? You need those people that you need failures in your life because that
helps
you. No, we need people to be comfortable to be able to fail and to not make it. And then somebody in 20 years time picks that up and go, you know what, this wasn't a bad album. How many times have we heard that over the recent years? All of a sudden something's number one in the charts and when it came out in the 1980s no one paid any attention to it. But it's
true. Very true.
Of my favorite albums are like albums that at the time people were like, Jesus, look at half of David Bowie's first four albums, no one listened to them. You know, but somebody said, I'll give him another chance. And all of a sudden he come up with Ziggy Stardust. The 3-4 albums before that, you know, like The Man Who Sold the World was, and Space Odyssey and Honky Dory were flops. They're all flops. They're like classic albums now. But if you didn't have those, if you didn't give him that space, you wouldn't have had like Low and all the other amazing albums he had, you know, like you wouldn't have David Bowie. David Bowie wouldn't exist in the art world, in the music world today, because who would get past their first album if nobody brought it? You know, nobody came to your concerts. If you turned up and you got, you know, 2,000 people like downloaded your album or wherever it's worked out nowadays, the record company would drop you like a fucking stone, like a hot brick. You'd be gone. And that's what I'm saying.
I don't know how it's working. I don't know how it's working for Forge Side Chat because no one's listening to the show besides my mom, and somehow Maritime Knife Supply is still willing to take care of us. Actually, even Abana's taking care of us. They've got their 50th anniversary coming up June 6th to 9th in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. I don't know if you've caught wind of the 50th anniversary or not.
Yeah, I've heard about it. Yeah.
It's supposed to be pretty big, right, man?
Yeah, go to abana.org
and find out more about the event. There's going to be team forging competition going on. There's going to be educational tents going on. There's going to be great demonstrations going on. That's June 6th to 9th in Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so it's going to be a good one.
They always are, but this one being the 50th, it's probably going to be extra special, eh?
I would say so. A bit jealous of people that are going to be going to it.
Yeah, me too, man. It's not falling into a timeline that works for me to be able to go to it, but for those that are going to be attending it, you guys are lucky ducky for sure. Yeah. I got to get going right away here. I've got friend of mine waiting outside for me. He just showed up. But really quick before we call or quits, one of the things that didn't come up that we always like to hear about is what's your favorite go-to hammer, hand hammer?
Oh, it's just a hammer, a 3-pound cross peen that I made myself.
Cross peen?
I love a cross peen. I love a cross peen hammer. So I use that 90% of the time. And then I've got a couple of the light hammers and I've got heavier hammers, but and then, you know, rounding hammers and ball peen, but the cross peen is always my go-to.
Nice.
You know, it's very adaptable, and you know, it's more adaptable than any other hammer, I feel. Although I know loads of people, they love the ball peen hammers, but
I realized something. I did not start the episode off in my normal fashion with you. We didn't say good day, and I didn't give my welcome to another Forge Side Chat, a podcast about blacksmithing and bladesmithing and everything in between, with a heavy focus on talent in the Great White North, Canada. But today we're over in Ireland talking to Michael Budd. And where did I miss popping that in the episode, dude?
Because we started talking shit before you could get to it.
Well, Michael, man, thank you so much for sitting down and giving me your time. I know you've been listening to the podcast quite a bit in the past, and I really appreciate
you being a part of our journey. The Forge most days, actually.
That's awesome, man.
I just listen away to it while I'm working. It's nice to have a bit of company in the Forge.
That you messaged me back and forth about the show too. I really appreciate your feedback and that you're a fan of the show, man. And now you're one of our guests. It's awesome to have you on, man.
Oh no, it's great. I've really enjoyed it. Nice talking to you.
Yeah, likewise. You've been a listener, so I think you know how this ends. You want to help me out with this?
I'll have a go. I actually had to go and research Bob and Doug. Because I didn't know what the fuck you were talking about, you know. So I had to go and find it. I had to go and find it on YouTube.
Well, let's see how good your research was.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's probably going to be very poor. It's going to be very poor. Don't get your hopes up.
Good day.
Good day, yeah.
Yeah, good enough, eh?
Huh?
Awesome, buddy. Thanks again. You know, it's funny because I say Bud a lot. Like, thanks, Bud. Hey, Bud. Good day, Bud. And your last name being Bud. I'm like, how many times is this guy going to be annoyed with me using the word Bud?
No. Do you know what? I'm used to it. And it was really weird when I moved to Ireland because I think there's one other Bud in the whole of Ireland apart from my family. So they're in Dublin. So everyone's like, Jesus. Everyone sort of like, when they first hear your name here, is like, Jesus. And they immediately think of Budweiser, which really annoys me as well.
Yeah.
But, I don't mind.
Especially if it's Bud Light, right?
Oh, Jesus.
Don't associate you with that one.
You got to get yourself a good proper, like, homebrew or something, or a nice craft beer.
Nice. I can appreciate that, man. I know there's probably a lot more that we could have talked about, man, and I would definitely encourage us to sit down again in the future and have another chat when we get the chance.
Yeah.
So we'll stay in touch, and you have yourself a good day, bud.
You too. You too. Nice speaking to you.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening this far in. Don't forget to go check out thetoolerlinseed.com. They've got some excellent linseed oils. It's food safe, hand-grown, handmade, right in Saskatchewan, Canada, by some brothers on their family farm. You can use the code FORGECHAT10 at checkout and save yourself 10% on orders $50 or more. That's at thetoolerlinseed.com.
Much ready to go, bud?
Yeah. Work away.
Okay. I'm going to apologize right up. I'll be straight up forward with you. I don't know a lot about you, dude. I have listened to you on Blacksmither Radio, but
yeah,
that was a little while ago that I listened to those episodes, man. It's been a while.
It was a good 5-6 years ago, maybe.
Really? Wow.
It must be. Well, it was when was Can I and X? It was the year after Can I and X, because I met Victoria at Can I and X in Cape Breton.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have definitely been a while ago, because they just had Can Iron 13. They just had that, so. Hmm. That would have been, probably about 6 years ago then, because it's every 2 years, right?
Every 2 years. But it didn't go ahead during the pandemic, did it? So
I don't think it did. Yes, it did. Guess who hosted a virtual version of CanIron?
Oh, did you? Oh, cool.
Yeah, if you head over to caniron.ca, there is the virtual edition of CanIron that went down during the pandemic. Myself and Justin Lamoureux were the hosts of that entire event. We brought on a bunch of people to do chats with and go over how they do things. We did a couple somewhat like podcast episodes where we just got to learn about the lives of different people. We had a couple of people do like educational chats where they talked about their processes and how they go about doing their processes. We even had somebody do a couple demonstrations on how to make a few different items, and they did slideshows. And we had Mark Asprey and Victoria Ritter come in from the CBA, along with John Williams. Mark Pierce was one of our headliners from Canada, from Calgary area.
Yeah.
We had Daryl. Not Daryl Markowitz. Shoot, I'm forgetting the last name here now. He's going to be mad at me for forgetting his last name. Richardson. Not Daryl Richardson. Oh, shoot. Ah, man, I'm going to have to go look up the lineup. This is terrible that I'm forgetting. I forget all the names. There's like 30 different
people. I'm terrible with names.
Yeah. Okay, well, maybe I'm falling into that category. It comes with age, right?
No, I've always been bad. Always been bad with it. Like,